Hi everyone, welcome to Padlock Food Talks. Today we're in the middle of somewhere in La Rioja with Jade Gross and Phil. And we're going to talk about Rioja wines, how a chef becomes a winemaker and this sort of things.
Yeah, because you've got a crazy story, no? Like how you, because you weren't a chef originally, no? You were in translating, like internationally?
I studied human rights law.
Right.
Okay.
And I realized that I couldn't save the world. That's what I wanted to do. I thought I had the solution. And I don't know, I was naive. I was 18. And but I still finished my studies. And at the end of the day, I decided to save my own world.
Okay.
If you will. And yeah, I guess I have always had a curious mind and I always wanted to try to do different things. I just never knew it was going to be either being a chef or making wine. Like if you had told me this when I was 18, I probably wouldn't have believed you. But again, if you have the passion for it and you have the drive, there's nothing else, nothing really can stop you.
And how was this transition from international law to cooking?
Well, it wasn't easy.
How did it start? What was the spark?
Well, so I had I was doing a master's in London in human rights law, and I was going to finish, and obviously the next step would obviously work in a law firm and, you know, that whole story after that. But I was with a friend who was in law school for 2 weeks, and her dad is a lawyer, and she dropped out, and she started working in a nonprofit organization, sort of startup, called Escape the City. And Escape the City is basically a startup that basically helps people who have really more serious jobs leave those jobs and create their own project, whether it's photography or they want to be a ballet dancer or something like totally opposite of what they studied. And so she was really in this, like, you should do what you want. You should be free and be happy. So we're in this, like, period. And I said, well, she's like, what makes you happy? I was like, well, I really don't know. I mean, I love to eat. And I like to go to different restaurants. That's always has been part of me. And, yeah, she's like, why don't you apply to a culinary school? And I said, well, I don't think they'll take me because I have absolutely no professional experience. And I guess I was a really good writer. And I applied to one culinary school in Paris called École Ferrandi.
Ah, yeah, of course. Yeah. It's one of the big schools in France.
One of the bigger schools, yeah. In the Chamber of Commerce, yeah. And when I got in, I was like, wow, I wrote a really good essay then. and I didn't want to ask my parents to pay for my studies because they had paid for everything else. And so I applied for a grant at James Beard Foundation.
Yeah.
And when I got the grant, I thought it's once in a lifetime. And so I finished my master's and I went to Paris. And the thing was, I obviously wasn't the fastest chef and I probably didn't cut the mirepoix really well. And I was always, yeah, I guess always a little bit behind because I was also a little bit older than everybody else. I was 23 and everyone else was basically 16, 17, you know. And when I finished the culinary studies, part of the program is that you have to pick a place to do an internship. And I knew that I really loved the whole education system, but I really think that it's 20% of the reality of a real kitchen.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And so I thought, okay, well, if I'm really going to do this, I only want to work in the best restaurants in the world, and I'm going to pick the hardest place I can find right now and see if I can last. Because if not, then I know it's not for me. So I picked Alain Ducasse in Place Athénée.
Okay.
Which is a 3-star, yeah. Super classical
French. Which
is
pretty damn hot.
Yeah,
as hot goes.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And it was difficult. It was hot. I think I cried for like the first 6 months.
Oh, no.
And when I went home, I called my mother because there was a time difference between Hong Kong and Paris. And I said, I can't do it. And she's like, no. After everything, you're going to leave halfway. She's like, no, you start something, you finish it. And I'm really happy she told me this because I ended up finishing my internship. And I asked myself if all the kitchens were like that. So I went to Brazil and I was in Dom for about 2 months. But at least I knew how they worked over there. Then I wanted to go to El Bulli, but that was the year that they closed. So then my next...
So this was around 2012, 2013?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Then my next option was El Selle de Can Roca,
yeah.
But they had no space. So I ended up in Mugaritz. And I was there the first year, and for me, I absolutely loved it. Again, I wasn't the best chef there, but I guess I was very quiet and I did my job. And but also the way they treated people for me was very different from what I experienced previously. And then after 1 year, I did go to El Seyer. I was there for a few months, and obviously that's more family style, very different. You're with the brothers, you eat with the family, and I think, yeah, that's super cool. Yeah, and then I thought, okay, well, since I have such a nomadic lifestyle that I was going to travel the world, and every couple or every 6 months or 12 months I was going to move, there was an opportunity to go to Faviken. But then Danny Lassa from Mugaritz called me, and I went back to Mugaritz, and I was there for about 7 years.
Okay, amazing. You were there as a head chef the last time I went to eat. That was 2016?
Yeah, so when I got into Mugaritz, I was 24. And when I was 26, I was head chef.
Okay.
So in 2 years. And but like I said, I probably had the least experience out of everybody there of being a chef in general. But I guess, you know, I don't know. I guess if you really have the drive and the commitment, the passion, and you take it as if it's your own, knowing that it's not your own, it's not your own restaurant, but you feel that it is yours, then yeah, I think, I don't know, I guess right place, right time. And then after being head chef, I thought I was going to leave, actually. And the R&D department, there was someone had left. And I thought that I would probably never be in an R&D anywhere else in the world in such a short amount of time. And so I thought it was another opportunity. So then I stayed for another 3 years.
What can you share, like, I don't know, like some anecdotes or highlights about being in Mugaritz for 7 years? What are your key takeaways?
I think it's very subjective, and because I know of experiences that are maybe not so positive. But for me in general, I mean, obviously being a chef, as you know, it's hardcore, and you really have to love what you do, because if not, that drive is not there for you, because it's not just the physical, it's obviously the emotional, it's the mental, and that what really makes you either really tired or give up, right? For me, it was a place that, when I got into Mugaritz, basically, let's say it like this, I was a person that had no confidence, and after 7 years, I became a much more confident person, not only in myself, but also in trusting people, and delegating, and basically they gave me a chance to lead when I never thought I was probably going to be a good leader anyways. And just little chances like that for me that make me grew as a person. And I think that Andoni actually always says that, you know, if you want the recipes, we'll give it to you. And probably the next day you leave, but we're here to teach you how to be a person and how to interact in society. And I think that's something that money can't even buy, you know. You can't even study that. It's an experience. But I know... It's very hardcore, and you basically sleep thinking about Mugaritz, you wake up thinking about Mugaritz. It's basically your world, and you're in this bubble.
It's like a sect somehow, right?
It's almost like a sect, and actually, when you leave the sect, it's a little bit weird.
It's super weird.
It's super weird.
Yeah, absolutely. We've talked about this. I started in Mugaritz in 2005, and I mean, I wasn't for long, like for 6 months, but after I left, it was like... Why?
What do I do now?
Yeah.
Yeah,
why,
totally.
Why aren't things the same way organized as in Mugaritz, you know? Yeah. Like, this is not the way it's supposed to be.
Yeah, it's so rough. I mean, like, when I, you know, the entire time you're there, it's kind of like you're working your ass off and you're pushing. Also because you're surrounded by a lot of people that do the same, you know? Mm. Like, obviously, you have the couple of stagiaires that come in and out and then they fall off and whatever.
Yeah.
But you have such a big... a group of people that are, you know, made up of individuals from all around the world that are really exceptional and really inspiring. Mm. And it's like you say, I've rarely had a restaurant where you feel this culture, this sort of almost ritualistic culture of sort of like, this is how we do things, this is how we approach things, this is how we work, this is our work ethic. And when I left, I was almost like on the verge of depression, because I was like, what the fuck am I going to do now? Like, I don't, like, it was so hard, but at the same time, I was like, I don't want to leave, you know?
Right.
Like, I don't want to leave this. I don't want to stop feeling like I do when I work here.
Right.
Yeah.
I think the hardest thing as well is when you have one foot in one world and you have one foot in the other world, is take that foot that's still in the old world and bring it forward. I think that's the hardest thing to do. Whether it's changing careers, which is what I did, or leaving one place that you're so used to and then going to a new place, you just need, like, a... time to, I don't know, like adaptation,
yeah,
to adapt in a new world that you're living in. But yeah, it's almost like a sect because, you know, you live with the same people that you work with. You go out with them as well. And yeah, so yeah. You travel with them. Yeah, so you...
And on your spare time, you were talking about work and things like...
The cooking.
What had happened in
the leaf
service.
Was not in the proper position of the plate. You know, like, that's crazy.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Yeah. So when was the first spark there where you kind of decided, you know, you had put like, because I mean, when I met you, you had so like such a drive, you know, and you could really feel it that you were in the place like with your entire being, you know. Mm-hmm. When was the first time that you kind of thought, hey, maybe, you know, at some point you want to open a new chapter, you know, and kind of go into this whole winemaking?
Yeah, that's actually a good question because nothing that I'm doing now was planned. Everything just... either fell into place or, again, right place, right time, and also because someone believed in me. So in 2014, I had bought my first car, and I decided to travel around Spain with the car. And I had asked a sommelier at Mugrit some recommendations for wineries nearby. So here in Rioja, we're about 1.5 hours from San Sebastian, more or less. And he had sent me to these very big wineries, and obviously the experience was beautiful, but for me it was almost as if it was repetitive, the experience, going to a winery of that particular size. And so I had asked him to send me to a place that was a little much smaller, more personal. He had sent me to see a couple. The winery is called Abel Mendoza. That's the guy's name, and his wife, Maite. And they live in this town, which is behind us, San Vicente La Sonchera, which is a town of 1,000 people. And when I went there, I obviously was very shy, very respectful, and it was a very unknown world. And actually, I was not really familiar with Spanish wine until I got into Mugrit. Be careful, don't fall. And yeah, so we started, I bought some wine, and then I came back a few months later, bought more, and then we started a friendship, and then I started helping out here and there in harvest, at bottling, and just being with them and just learning. Now they're in their mid-60s, so I had met them in 2014, so it's been 11 years now. When I left Mugrit's, which was December of 2017, I didn't know I was going to make wine. Actually, I thought that I was going to open a restaurant because that was probably the most logical thing to do, I guess. And Andoni, when I told him I was going to leave, he's like, where are you going to go? Who are you going to work for? Where are you going to go? I was like, I have no idea. And I think he didn't really believe me, but I really had no idea. And I think it was the first time in my life where I had no idea what I was going to do. But I knew that I had to leave because I felt, you know, I've been there for 7 years. I guess I left my little grain of sand, and I thought it was going to be a new chapter for me. But I knew that I didn't want to work for anyone else. That I knew. It had to be my own thing. And so I decided to see if I could open my own restaurant in Hong Kong. But then, I don't know, it just felt too forced. And one day I had asked Abel if he thought it was going to a good idea that, I don't know, make 800 bottles of wine, and worst comes to worst, I drink it with my parents. I don't know, like, it's the worst comes to worst kind of situation. And at first he said no. He didn't think it was a good idea because I'm not from here. I'm not from Rioja, and everyone in Rioja knows everybody. And you think that in the chef world, everyone knows everybody, but the world of wine is ridiculous. Everybody knows everybody, and everyone finds out all the information as well.
Yeah, the only person I know is Gian Marcos, and you know him.
Yeah, exactly. See? And I'm not from here. I have no experience. The world of... maybe the winery, it's more, you can more or less control it. But in the vineyard, you're really faced with nature, and here we don't use any irrigation. Everything is just really what you get. So if it's lack of rain, then there's drought, et cetera, et cetera. So things that a person, you would need experience. You can't teach that in school, you know. And since I'm a little bit more stubborn than him and very persistent, I said I wanted to try to make 2 barrels. But I had no idea that the project would be where it is now. Like, I think the feedback has been super positive from everybody. It's not your most conventional story in the world of wine. Usually it's generations of, or families inheriting vineyards and wineries. And obviously, I get really jealous because I wish I had all the vineyards that they have, and I wish that I had all the experience that they had. And so in the first few years making wine, I mean, it sounds weird to say it, but it was a lot of trial and error, you know? So it reminded me a little bit of cooking, but it's long-term. Because cooking, you can make a dish now, and maybe you can repeat it and do it again tomorrow or the next day. But with the world of wine, every little thing that you do, you don't see the result in that moment. You see it a year later, and there's nothing you can do to take it back if you realize that that was not the right decision you had to make. So that's the risk that you have to take. And for me, with having no experience, it was a bit like, a bit weird. Because at the end of the day, you are defending a product.
Of course.
And you know, and people will drink it. And then they criticize it, or they don't, or they like it. It really depends. But yeah, so I convinced Abel that I really wanted to do it. And thanks to him, I found the first grape grower that wanted to sell me the grapes, because that's just an odyssey in itself. No one wanted to sell me any grapes as well, because I was not from here. I had to find another winery where I can make the wine. So I was, for about 5 years, always renting a space in someone else's winery. And it's never really your own, you know. Until last year, I built my own, because I thought, you know what, I'm just going to do it, because I can do whatever I want. No one's going to ask me questions. But thanks to him and his wife, she's the oenologist, and he's in basically everything, but he knows more about vineyards. They taught me everything I knew. And I think that if you have one person that believes in you in the world of wine, I think that's something that, again, something that you need to take into value, yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah.
We were commenting earlier on the control denomination of origin of the Rioja. Do you have it? Do you have it from the early beginning? And what do you need to have it? What are the requirements and the constraints?
So it's a denomination that it's an appellation. Yet I guess I have these strict rules that you need to abide by, not only in the vineyard but also in the winery. So when I started making wine, it was already in the Rioja denomination. Because since I was here and since my mentor also was part of it, he already told, he could sort of like guide me in of the things that I could and could not do. I like to follow rules, I guess. I respect rules, I respect tradition, and I think from there then you can grow me more moderate and leave if you want to. But I think you need to have a base. And it's also, you know, it's an appellation that wants to protect the quality of the wine that comes out from this region. It is pretty big, but there's only 400 wineries.
Okay.
So that basically means that most wineries are large, right? Because let's say I'm one of the 400, but I don't make a lot of wine, and there's millions and millions of bottles of Rioja. So I guess they try to control quality because not all the vineyards are Rioja. So you need to have this thing that they call the papel. And once you have that, there's basically, they trace everything that you do. You obviously have to write everything down. You just have to send them every month any information that you did or any movement of wine that you move. Let's say you move from one barrel to another one. All these things have to be really well written down and then pass this information. So they're quite strict in terms of they need to know where everything begins and ends. There's some things. I think I'm not big enough to do a lot of like weird and quirky things. So, but from what I have now, it's more or less in control, yeah.
Because I would expect that to be more natural as a chef becoming a winemaker to, I don't know, to break tradition and do stuff that is not so normal.
I think the project in itself is pretty breaking tradition already. So I think that's a lot. And because I mean, I know there are some Asian people making wine, but they're mostly in France. In Spain, I'm not sure. So, you know, at least I think breaking ground in the beginning took me a few years to, I guess, be accepted in the village.
Okay.
And that took a while. Yeah.
Yeah, I can imagine. It's a super, super brave move, you know? It's like unknown territory, you know? It's kind of like you say, you don't know how, like, what you do is going to affect it, like, in a year's time.
Right.
So it's kind of like venturing out into the unknown.
Right. Wow. No, definitely.
Yeah. For people who don't know much about winemaking and the process, like myself included, how would you say that your approach to winemaking differs from the regional styles?
That's a good question. So I think for a long time, historically, Rioja is a region, right? A lot of people who have had Rioja before, they think that Rioja is almost a style, because for many, many years they've been doing more or less the same kind of wine that's been aged for a very long time in barrel, with a lot of oak usage, and then a lot of bottling in the, a lot of aging in the bottle, and then coming into the market. So I, it's a wine that's, you know, very aged. And I think now the new generation is trying to break away from that. For me, I put more importance on single plots, because usually you can blend different plots to make a better wine. But for me, I was wanted to see, well, first for me, it's a personal experience of learning, but I wanted to make the best wine I can from one particular plot. And then for me, the next step would be the art of blending, which I think is also quite complex. So really small amount of wine. So for example, for one particular vineyard, which is the one right behind us, 1 year gives me 1,000 bottles. Maybe the next year would be 700 because there was hail, there was drought, there was frost. For me, obviously, the easiest thing would be to blend with another plot and then make the 1,000 bottles again. But I'm very loyal to whatever gives you that year. And you can actually then taste the difference of the vintages. And if someone explains that it was a year that was a lot of heat, or 1 year that was quite rainy, you can see that in the wine, if someone explains it to you. So I think for me, the story behind it is also just as important. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's kind of like, it sounds to me kind of like you're appreciating the natural like characteristics of it. It's kind of like, as you're so like at mercy of nature,
definitely,
that you kind of embrace the differences in it, not kind of standardizing it, but like embracing the differences in,
exactly,
like between the years and the weather and the conditions, no?
I mean, obviously, me as a person, I like to be in control of everything that I do. And I think in the kitchen, you can sort of more or less do that. But in winemaking, you cannot. You can guide it, but you can never control it.
Yeah.
Yeah, you just have to accept whatever comes out that year. I wouldn't say there's, well, some people say there's good and bad vintages. I just really think for me is, what's the best wine you can make from what you have? And I'm sure you can do it if you are really super strict and make decisions quickly, yeah. Mm.
You said you went a lot to restaurants while growing up. Most of these restaurants were Chinese restaurants or?
So I grew up obviously cooking or eating Chinese food, mostly Shanghainese food, which is it's a more saucy, more heavy, because it's northern, a little bit more northern Chinese, and so everything is a little bit more heavier. So since my grandmother was always cooking, I can't tell you that I was a chef because I was with my grandmother cooking in the in her kitchen. I just ate the food and I loved it, so. But you know, you need to know how to eat to be a chef, I think. You know?
Absolutely,
I
think that's really important. No. But for me, it makes completely sense to say that you would eat a lot from your grandmother.
But I was never in the kitchen. My mom never really allowed me to go in, so
okay.
I just ate. And I guess, you know, Hong Kong is also a multicultural city. You know, it was British for about 99 years. And so we were very exposed to Western foods. Obviously, the French had a lot of presence, German as well, and then British, obviously. Since I'm half-half, mostly exposed to Chinese culture.
Would you say that Chinese palate is reflected in your wine somehow?
So some people ask me what kind of food goes well with my wine, and I always say Chinese food. But it's true, actually, because, you know, depending on what kind of Chinese food you have very saucy, very heavy. If you have a really nice, acidic white wine, it really cuts that. Or if you have very spicy food, then you can have a young, unoaked wine that's really, a little bit more sweeter. That sort of also balances that. And I guess also being a chef, you also relate it to certain foods and certain ingredients that maybe in the world of wine they don't know about. Just because we're super freaky like that. We like to know all the different ingredients, like tonka bean or, like, I don't know, random things like that. You can relate to that. And I think that's quite interesting, to being a chef and making wine. Obviously, you know, maceration and fermentation, these are concepts used in cooking. But we use that in winemaking, right? So it's very similar. They're very parallel. It's just one is more long-term.
You know, I was like saying to like in the car that it's just like such a fascinating journey. You know?
It's a crazy ride.
Yeah.
It's been a crazy ride, and I don't know what's going to happen next.
Well, you showed us a batch that was going to be sent to Puerto Rico.
Yeah.
Where are your most crazy clients from?
Well, so it's funny because there was this international interest from the start. And like I mentioned, the wine was never really present in Spain just because We have so much wine here.
Mm. Of course.
There's so much Rioja, there's so much Ribera, there's so much wines from Galicia. I mean, Jerez
and
now
is
coming
so
back.
So deeply ingrained into the culture. Yeah. Like, yeah. Whoever here packed, understands wine when it's not good, you know, like,
definitely.
You can't fool anyone here with wine.
No, definitely. Yeah. So, you know, I guess, you know, when you, they always say, you know, making wine is difficult, but the hardest thing is selling your wine. Mm. Because the first year, all your friends are going to buy your wine just to, like, help you out. One or two cases, something like that. Then the second year, less friends will buy your wine, and you need to sort of branch out into distributing it. The third year, probably, like, a handful of friends. And then the fourth year, no one's going to buy your wine. No, none of your friends are going to buy your wine. And that is so true. Because you knew in the beginning, okay, they're going to help you out. But then, you know, it is a lot of wine, and the project is growing. I started with 800 bottles in 2019, and now it's 12,000. So it grew more than double exponentially.
Yeah.
For me, the coolest place is that it's in Hong Kong, because Hong Kong, they're very strict about what kind of wines they like to drink. Mm. Rioja now is making a big comeback in, or not comeback, actually making a scene in Hong Kong and China, just because they had so much French, Italian wine, and even Australian wine, because there's a lot of Australian people living in Hong Kong. And I think the differentiating point is that they have one of their own making wine. And I think that's the emotional factor. And that's the factor that they like to relate to. That, oh, yeah, you know, there's a girl from Hong Kong making wine. Oh, that's super cool, because there's not a lot of Hong Kong people making wine. Puerto Rico is a big market. New York.
That's crazy, Puerto Rico.
That's really random. But he's been there from the beginning.
Okay.
He bought a bunch of wines from 2019. And every year grows his order, so that I think that's something that's positive.
Yeah.
New York is also a big order. What else? Then it's in most of Europe, here and there. Italy and France, which for me also is quite surprising, just because, you know, French people like to drink French wine, and Italian people like to drink Italian wine, and then suddenly you have my wine there, you know. So, but for me, the most important thing is that all these people have to place the wine correctly. I think being a chef, you also know, like, where you want your wines to be. And so that's how I sort of started, you know. Here, there was a chef here and there, and I said, well, maybe could you get, like, a case of wine? And it just started being super gastronomic restaurants. And I think now that's, it sort of has been staying like that for a while.
Are there any, like, important or, like, super loyal restaurants that have been there from the beginning?
I mean, obviously, Mugrit is one of them. Randomly, I found out the other day it's in Geranium. Which I think is, which for me is super cool. Yeah, definitely. So I'm like, wow, this is, like, amazing, you know?
Yeah.
And in Hong Kong, it's pretty much, in all the Michelin restaurants, and China as well. Italy, so I'm very surprised. But I think the feedback has been positive. So I think that they look at the label, they like it, and then the wine's also good. So I'm happy with that, you know?
I was on a recent trip to Japan, and there is an emerging culture of local Japanese wines.
Yeah, they're really great. They're really great. Yeah.
I wasn't it was actually a pottery event. So there were ceramists from all over Japan. But the event also had some chefs invited, and all of the wines were local wines.
Cool.
And it was really interesting to see the.
Yeah, they have a lot of French varieties, and now they're making wines even in Hokkaido, which is super cold.
Yeah.
But really nice, really very fine and elegant Pinot Noir, which is really random. But see, you can't. Yeah, I think that's now, like, the world's going to change, you know, because you're making wine now in places where you didn't think you could make high quality wines, right?
Hmm.
Yeah. So yeah, for me, you know, the most important thing is where they're placed and telling the story, because at the end of the day, I can't tell a story to every single person. So you really need to have really good people who can communicate and also believe in the story, because, like I said, I've only been doing this for 6 years. I think maybe it's like you're watching, what is it, like history being made? Not history, but basically how the project began and where it can be in 20 years, it's going to be completely different. But you were there from the beginning, and you can see that that person and the wines have developed. Because every year for me, the objective is making a better wine than the previous year. And if not, I would not take out the product.
And do you see yourself sticking to the Rioja denomination or stepping aside from it?
I don't know. You know, for now, because when you have a winery in the Rioja denomination, you can't make non Rioja wine in the same physical space.
Mm. Okay.
I would have to build another winery.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's one of the rules, for example. So it would have to be declassifying everything that I do. So it's either all or nothing.
Yeah.
Okay, you can't do like half. So it, for me, it's a little bit risky for now.
That's pretty crazy. Yeah. I didn't know that there were all these.
That's intense.
I thought it was only regulating like the formulation, like the percentage of Tempranillo versus other grapes.
No. It's the winery. So when you build a winery, they come, they do an inspection, they do an audit 2 or 3 times a year. I mean, it's very strict. But if you decide that you don't want to do Rioja anymore, they would have to declassify everything that you do. So you would be a winery. You wouldn't have to submit to any of their rules, but you could never, ever do Rioja.
Again.
Like, it's very hard to come back.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow, that's crazy.
So once you make the decision, you need to be really clear. So actually, there's one winery in La Guardia, which is where in Rioja Alavés, about 15-minute drive. It's called Artadi. And they're a family-run winery, really big. But they're so big that they knew that they didn't even need Rioja anymore.
Okay.
So they left, but this was in the late 90s, early 2000. And they're still doing really well because their vineyards are absolutely amazing. They don't need it, but you need to be that kind of winery to do that.
No, and I also understand commercially it's very good for you to be Rioja, you know, it's like a good stamp.
I think for Rioja, I mean, I'm not a bad addition. I don't know, they would have to tell me, but I think it's okay. And I think now we're living in the time where there's a lot of people my age, obviously, inheriting vineyards, they're making sort of like very similar or parallel styles, and I think that it's changing the face of Rioja, and I think it's changing the conversation, which is also very important.
That's also something I want to understand, like how broad is the possibilities of styles within the denomination? Is it infinite or is it constrained somehow?
Depends how freaky you want to go.
Because for example, let's say Pilsner beer, you know, like they can be different, but they are all pretty much similar.
Okay.
And it's something.
I've only had one sort of Pilsner.
Bass cider.
Yeah.
You know, like they're similar, they're different, but they're all constrained.
I think if you try, you know, at the end of the day, you need to have, it's called like the hand of the grape grower, but also the hand of the person making the wine, because you can have, depending on what kind of quality grapes you get in, it's like in the kitchen, you know, 70% is product.
Mm-hmm.
And 30% is, you know,
execution.
Little tweaks, execution, right? I would say the same for winemaking. It's really important to have really good product. And then from there, making a great wine.
So, and can you play around with the product, like with the soil and some things? So that's also super controlled?
No, the soil is what it is. So you can have gravel soil, alluvial, you have limestone. There's a lot of limestone clay in this particular area. There's a little bit, there's also sand and sandstone, like arenisca. And so the beauty of it is you can, depending on the soil, even though it's the same particular grape, let's say you have 5 different soils, but it's the same grape, Tempranillo all around, the wines are all different.
Okay.
Because you play with altitude, you play with soil, you play with vigor. The older the vines are, the smarter they are. Actually, it's quite interesting. They control their own yield naturally. So you have more loose grapes, you have smaller berries, which is always what you want. You don't want to have fatty grapes because that's a lot of juice, so there's not a lot of concentration. So with these parameters, you can play around, and they're not strict on that. It's basically... they don't also tell you how you want to do conventional viticulture, which is basically with a lot of chemicals, you can do that. You want to be biodynamic, you can also do that. No one is saying no against that. I think there's a little bit more control in what is the winery. You can mix all the plots, but there's always going to be a percentage limit of how many grapes, white grapes you can add in a red wine or in a rosé, for example. So it really... And you also decide if you want to play the game or not.
Okay. Right? Okay. Yeah. Super interesting.
Yeah.
That's it for this week's episode of Potluck Food Talks. If you like what we're doing, make sure to subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode. You can also find us on Instagram and TikTok as Potluck Food Talks. The show airs every Monday.